Mr. Blackburn.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right.
My name is Celeste Blackburn. I'm here representing Marcus Hamilton. He was the defendant in the trial on this case. We're here on a felon in possession of a firearm charge where Mr. Hamilton was convicted by jury. I appreciate the court granting my oral argument because it's my firm belief that if the court finds that this trial court judge did not abuse her discretion in admitting the gang evidence testimony, that there's not going to be a case where a judge in the Fifth Circuit could err in that admission. This case occurred back in July 18th of 2009. Mr. Hamilton was first observed by Houston police officers driving slowly in an apartment complex and looking around, and he then parked his car and went into the apartment complex. The testimony at trial was uncontroverted that he had no narcotics on him at that point. He was not seen going in anywhere with narcotics or coming out with narcotics. Yet the HPD officers believed that they, quote, had a narcotics transaction at that point. And so they began following Mr. Hamilton to develop some probable cause. At a certain point, Mr. Hamilton realizes someone is following him and pulls and parks into a parking spot in a shopping center. The undercover officers are following him, and the testimony at trial to prove that he was in possession of a firearm is that as an officer drove by Mr. Hamilton's parked car, the officer observed Mr. Hamilton's hands and head outside of a window, and that his left hand was rebounding down, and that in his left hand he had a hat, which was dropped on the ground, that he got out of his car and picked up and put back on. After Mr. Hamilton walked around the shopping center for about 25 minutes, looking around for the people that were following him, because there were people following him, he returned to his car, left. The officers then claimed he did not signal a lane change, so they stopped his vehicle. At trial, evidence was introduced that when Mr. Hamilton was pulled over, there was a smell of marijuana in his car, that they found a scale with some alleged marijuana residue on it, and based on that, they called a drug dog out. And the drug dog did not alert on the car, despite the officer's testimony that the car smelled of marijuana, but the drug dog did alert on $1,800 cash that was in Mr. Hamilton's pocket. Based on that, they believe they had a narcotics deal and that he had thrown narcotics earlier at the shopping center. The officers return there and they find two spaces over, in between the front passenger tire and the curb, a gun perfectly landed there that Mr. Hamilton allegedly threw while he also had a hat in his hand. The officers testified they never saw him throw anything. They had different versions of what was said on the radio. But based on that, the trial court judge, Judge Atlas, decided that evidence that Mr. Hamilton was a gang member was admissible to show his motive for possessing a gun. She specifically found that there was a probative link between gang membership and the likelihood that he would be in possession. There were no other facts that indicate that he had this gun in his possession for anything related to gang activity. And then she found that the prejudice that was caused by introducing this evidence was not unfair because Mr. Hamilton allegedly admitted being in this gang. That
was this objection preserved?
The gang evidence was, yes, Your Honor.
And were you the trial counsel?
I was not, Your Honor. When she made this finding, she was proffered by the U.S. attorney that prosecuted this case that Mr. Hamilton admitted to being in the gang. However, the testimony that actually came out after Judge Atlas let it in was that the HPD officer found a quote-unquote hit in his computer system, that he was a documented member of the Black Gangster Disciples, and that the officer turned around to Mr. Hamilton and said, "You're a Black Disciple?" And Mr. Hamilton said, "Yeah, I was." So there was not an admission that on the date he was in possession or alleged possession of this firearm that he was a gang member. And for those reasons, I believe that her instruction or her ruling was incorrect and was an abuse of discretion. There's a whole lot of other things that I'd like to say that go along with that.
Did the information come out that he said, "I was a gang member"?
It did, Your Honor. The officer specifically said, "Are you a member?" And he said, "Yes, I was."
But it came out at trial that way.
It did, yes, Your Honor. That's directly quoting the transcript.
There's no testimony by the same officer or anybody that he had gang tattoos or other gang signs that are typically gang members have tattoos, signs, and other indicia of gang membership here, either BD or something similar. Is his, meaning the officer's testimony, solely that the defendant said he had been a member, or did the testimony include anything else aside from the statement?
The specific officer that testified to the gang evidence testified that he was not wearing gang colors, that he was not associated that day with any other gang members around him, and that he was obviously not throwing any gang signs. That officer testified that he redocumented him that day based on his quote-unquote admission and based on his tattoos. And when the court is able, as you can see in the transcript, there's a whole lot of discussion as to whether or not Mr. Hamilton has a BD tattoo on his neck, which would be representative of a gang. And the court can see even in the PSI that he has Big Marcus tattooed on his neck. There is no there is no gang tattoos on him. So, okay. This is a little bit different because Judge Atlas, there was a pretrial conference where she said, "I don't know why state or government you gave notice of this 404B. I don't know why you're going to use this. This isn't right. This is a felon in possession case." The government then submits proposed jury instructions where the court included as a 404B limiting instruction, and the court took it out because she said that she didn't see how any of this was going to be relevant in a felon in possession case. And throughout the trial, you'll see in the transcript that the government is continuing to try to present this gang evidence. They proffered that it was for knowledge, and the court rejected that. They proffered that it was for plan or preparation, and finally they were able to convince her, based on the testimony of a gang expert outside the presence of the jury, that it was admissible for motive. The government didn't designate this witness as an expert, didn't give notice of it, so that witness was precluded from testifying at trial. So the way that this played out in front of the jury is based on this very weak evidence, even to support a finding of guilt of being a felon in possession of a weapon. At the end of all of the testimony, the government recalls one of the officers, and that officer testifies solely to this gang evidence that he is a member of the criminal street gang, and that I've arrested between 50 to 100 people who are in gangs, and they have drugs and guns on them when I arrest them. That's the evidence that the jury had in front of them. In this case, it's further harmed because there was no limiting instruction given to the jury when the evidence was presented to them, or in the jury charge. The court removed the proposed 404B charge that the government had put in, and like I had to concede in my brief, for some reason Mr. Hamilton's trial attorney did not request an instruction, but this is a case and a point of error of mine that it was so obvious that it needed to be included that the trial court should have included it herself. And so there's also a plain error point of
What was the argument the government made to the jury about this evidence?
They argued in their opening statement that he was a gang member and a drug dealer, even though there's no evidence that he was drug dealing. There was a scale with some residue that was not even tested that was in his car. He had no drugs that were found on him. And then in closing argument, the government also argued it there, that it was his motive for possessing it, because drug dealers have guns, and that guns are more likely gang members have them to protect themselves. Even though in this case there was no factual basis to believe that Mr. Hamilton needed this gun for protection. And in some of the cases that I believe the government is going to argue to the court, where specifically the Seventh Circuit has found that it was not improper for the evidence to be admitted, those cases are very fact-specific. One of them, the defendant gave a statement saying, my brothers were supposed to let me know when you were coming in, the police. And he had bodyguards that he had hired for himself that had guns that ended up being the gun that he was charged with possessing. So there the court said, well, the government needs to explain these specific threats. And also she allowed that in because he had specific threats on his life. So there's very specific instances. As the trial court said here, she found that this is probative just because you're a gang member, therefore you have guns. I don't know how else to characterize just general bad character evidence that's being admitted, that's being used to obtain a conviction against someone.
Did he defend against the charge otherwise that this was his gun?
Oh, yes, ma'am. He claimed throughout the trial that it was not his gun, that he didn't throw anything.
Did he testify?
He did not.
Okay.
He did not.
Did they have fingerprints or any other proof connecting the gun to him?
No, Your Honor. The government did call a fingerprint, what we call a negative fingerprint expert, to say that there were no prints, but that was not unusual. Just based on the facts that I presented to you, the government called 9 witnesses at this trial, of which only one officer allegedly saw any kind of constructive or actual possession, and that was Officer Sanchez. Officer Sanchez specifically testified that it appeared as if he tossed something, but I never saw a gun thrown. There's never any direct evidence. All the other officers were called to testify about the drugs. That's what they were called for, is to give this implication that Mr. Hamilton is a drug dealer, and therefore that's why he had the gun in the car, even though they had absolutely no evidence that he was involved in drug trafficking. Again, that's a point of error, and again, his trial counsel for some reason did not object to any of that evidence. As I pointed out in my brief to the court, I think any objection she would have made would have been unnecessary because the court specifically stated that she was going to let it in because, quote, guns and drugs go together. And, you know, respectfully, based on other cases that this court has issued, specifically United States versus Sumlin, it's not just an automatic, we think you're a drug dealer, therefore that can be admitted. That's just not how it is. There has to be some evidence under a 403 standard that he is a drug dealer.
Well, we get a number of these cases in which, there's sort of a dual argument. The drugs are intrinsic, therefore, by definition, they're inextricably intertwined with the crime, therefore it comes in, or if not, it's extrinsic, and therefore it comes in under 404B, and many of our cases just roll it out and say, well, even if it's intrinsic or extrinsic, either way, no error, da, da, da. Now, in Sumlin, the panel said the evidence was intrinsic, and in that case, they reversed the district court, saying that even under the applicable standard of review, because the evidence was light or shaky, the evidence was reversible and it was vacated. And I mean, I know that we have other cases which go the other way. So what case is this case, more similar to? I mean, they're all fact intensive and we probably have more cases that affirm either would it be an intrinsic or extrinsic, but my recollection off the top of my head, the panels tend to say it's extrinsic and apply the 404B Beecham test for reasons analytically it's a little bit easier to deal with, to be frank, than trying to figure out what's intrinsic where temporally the guns and the drugs are not, right there and all that. With embedded in that is just the question, is this case closer to someone or closer to other cases, or exactly was that argued at the district court?
The case that was presented to the district court was a case that was just a felon in possession charge where the defendant's defense was necessity. I had to have a gun on me because I'm in a gang and people are trying to kill me. And I think that's completely distinguishable on the facts of this case. There is no type of defense like that that's put forth by Mr. Hamilton. It's a simple, I did not throw a gun defense. I believe that Sumlin is the most accurate to the facts of this case. In that case, there was no drugs that were found except for a marijuana cigar. So actually in Sumlin, there was more narcotics found than in this case, which was quote unquote some marijuana residue on a scale. So there's a huge difference. In that case, there was at least some actual narcotics that could be used In this case, as the drug, as the trial court referred to it, it's just drug paraphernalia that was found, which certainly doesn't rise to the level of drug trafficking, which then makes the gun come in. With respect to the court's question about other cases where gang evidence and drug evidence has come in, the majority of those cases, almost all the ones that I have found, are cases where the defendants were charged with conspiracies to sell narcotics. And so as part of that, the relationship of the co-conspirators, the relationship of their enterprise that they're charged with running, the gang becomes important. That is not what we have here. It is a one-count felon in possession case where the reality is one officer should have all that was necessary to testify that, look, I observed his hand rebound down, and based on that, we went back and I found a gun. All this other evidence is not intrinsic to that specific offense there.
Where was his cap?
I'm sorry?
What happened to his cap?
The officer testified that he had the cap in his hand and that he dropped it, that he got out of the car, bent down, put the cap back on his head, and then went into the shopping center. So he would have had to throw the gun with the cap and have it land perfectly in between the wheel and the curb, two spaces over. And that's also why I raised a sufficiency of evidence. The evidence in this case is the jury, while they were deliberating, sent out three notes about the officer's testimony. What you have, though, based on what this ruling is if you're in a gang, and that gang can be tried to any kind of criminal offense, let's say possession of marijuana, theft, then that can just be admissible as general motive without any specific facts to go in and argue it. That is a very serious policy concern for this court to consider under the facts of this case when issuing its opinion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've reserved time for rebuttal. Mr. Turner?
May it please the court. This case illustrates the difficulty the police encounter when they go proactive as opposed to reactive in investigating crime. The problem we have on appeal is Hamilton advances four issues to which the district court only had a chance to address two at trial. First, with respect to the evidence of Hamilton's possession of drug paraphernalia, not necessarily drugs, he possessed drug paraphernalia. The case begins with a police team whose mission is to go into high crime areas in the city of Houston, designated high crime areas. They divide, there's 9 or 10 of them, they divide out two, and they observe individuals within that area, ostensibly to ferret out crimes as they're being committed. In this particular instance, the sergeant observed Mr. Hamilton going into an apartment complex.
What time of day was it?
2:30 in the afternoon, Your Honor, July 18th, 2009.
Driving a Buick LeSabre.
Driving a Buick LeSabre, and he just observed him. And it just caught his attention. At that time, he said it piqued his interest. He didn't stop him. He didn't arrest him. He watched. He watched the individual go in and out of the apartment complex, appear to go to nowhere. He came out and he said, well, I'm going to follow him. He noted his other team members. I'm following this fellow in this Buick LeSabre to see where he goes and see what happens. He's suspicious. The suspicion is more based upon the context of where he is and what he's there to do as opposed to anything harder than that. But he still doesn't interfere.
What do you mean he's suspicious on?
It's basically
where he's there and what he wants to do.
Well, his mission there is to observe to see if there's any drug transactions. That's their principal role, is drug transactions and gang interdiction.
I understand what the police officer are looking for, but the question is, what did they see that?
All he saw him do was go in and out of the apartment complex, apparently going absolutely nowhere. And at that time, no arrest is made, no stop is made. He follows him, and then he notices he jumps a lane, makes a lane change.
No, they did a turn. That's what they do. I mean, that's just the real world. They're going to stop and check him out, and they don't have a probable cause. They know that, and so they wait to get wait till he finds some technical violation, perfectly legal, to stop him. Well, that's what really happened, isn't it? Sure it is.
Eventually what happens, after these observations take place, they initiate the stop. They watch the lane change, they make the lane change, they make the stop.
Sure.
Here's when the drug paraphernalia is discovered in the car. It's not drugs per se, it's drug residue on a scale.
Yeah. What exactly, you don't paraphernalia, gender, what are you talking about?
Well, we're talking about the scale, basically, the paraphernalia. I mean, most users don't usually carry their own scale with
them. A single scale.
A scale covered with residue, apparently marijuana.
Yeah.
And that was what they had.
Did the dog ever have a chance to alert on to that?
The testimony is that the dog only alerted on the cash. That okay. It only alerted on the cash, $1,800 in cash, which was found on his person.
So the residue, how do we know, what's the evidence that that was drug residue? The dog wouldn't alert on it.
It was the officer detected the smell of marijuana. There was no question asked, no objection lodged, so it was accepted that he detected the aroma of marijuana, saw the residue on it, and then they called the dog and alerts on a scale. No objections lodged at this point in time.
All right, I'm just trying to understand. First time I've ever encountered an officer with smell superior to a dog.
Well, alas, unfortunately, Your Honor, I've seen it in many cases in the last 24 years. Where
well, yeah, I expect you have.
The olfactory senses are more attuned than the dog's in many instances. So what we have, though, because there's no objection, we're in a question of plain error. As confronting the judge, it's plain error. The first case is there error at all?
Yeah.
The judge, as was pointed out during the pretrial conference, we submitted, out of an abundance of caution, for the trial of USA, a charge limiting consideration of extrinsic evidence. The judge didn't see it as an extrinsic evidence issue, and in this particular instance, he looked upon it as intrinsic evidence. In fact, it was the reason that they sent Officer Sanchez back to the parking lot when the dog alerted on the money. They sent Officer Sanchez, the officer who observed the throwing motion, they sent him back to the parking lot to see what was thrown underneath the vehicle next to him. Ostensibly, they suspected at that juncture the drugs were thrown there. It turned out to be the firearm. And as counsel pointed out, I'm going to cite Seventh Circuit cases because apparently they have a rather lengthy jurisprudence on gang affiliation evidence and gang evidence. In the case of U.S. versus Lloyd, first off, we think it's strictly intertwined. In U.S. versus Lloyd, they observed that evidence is involved in and explains circumstances of the crime charged. In this particular instance, that's precisely why we went back and found the gun. We found the marijuana residue. It provides background and development of the crime charged, and the possession of the scales and the residue cover scale basically is why we found the gun. So my suggestion is that here, the first prong of the plain error test hasn't been met with respect to this evidence. Turning next to the affiliation, gang affiliation as opposed to gang membership. And I approached this with a caveat from the Seventh Circuit in a recent case of U.S. versus Harris, which you'll find at 587 Fed 3rd 861, a 2009 case which consolidates cases. And they put this caveat to the submission of gang affiliation evidence. It's evidence of gang membership can be inflammatory, with the danger being that it can lead the jury to attach a propensity for committing crimes to defendants who are affiliated with gangs, or that a jury's negative feeling toward gangs will influence its verdict. Guilt by association is a genuine concern whenever gang evidence is admitted. In the cases U.S. versus Harris and in the other case I found, U.S. versus Lloyd, which is found at 71 Fed 3rd 1256, Seventh Circuit case, the judges, as the judge here was, genuinely concerned with admitting evidence of the gang affiliation.
Why did the government, did he have, was this in his conviction history that he was in the gang?
It was the officer that was involved in the stop, I believe, Officer Abel. He found it. Well, first off, they ran a computer check. And the city of Houston keeps what they call a gang tracker program. And Mr. Hamilton's name came up in the gang tracker program together with his affiliation. So looking at the computer program, he leans back and he says, "You were a black disciple." And the answer was, "I was," which means he was affiliated with the gang. And that the expert that attested to on the expert, first off, before the judge admitted it, she had a lengthy hearing outside the presence of the jury with what precisely this gang affiliation evidence would be. Thereafter, we called one witness back, that was Abel, who testified that he ran the computer check and found this information. The judge didn't admit it until after she had an extensive hearing on it. And then she went a lengthy set of findings, which I put out in a brief in total, believing that she limited it to consideration for motive. That is, the reason that these people that are affiliated with gangs do it for their protection as well as for the protection of the contraband. In the cases of the Seventh Circuit, it was mostly personal protection. And here, conceitedly, the U.S. attorneys weren't exactly precise on why they were offering this, but they were offering it on motive. In the end, the judge limited it to motive. And once again, there was no request.
For several reasons, and finally hit on motive. That was the one thing she would listen to.
Yes. Well, she heard. Well, she went all the way through this. She was reluctant.
I know, but you turned them down, and it came, then they went to the motive, right?
Till they got to motive. She turned them down consistently all the way through. She was very careful in assessing this, and she was reluctant. In fact, I was surprised when she did admit it into the record. But she admitted it, and that was more surprising. It didn't come back with a limiting instruction. There was no limiting instruction requested.
Well, she said, as I recall, no, I'm just going to let it all in. It's all in now. Have at it.
At that juncture,
then you came back with a witness, an expert witness.
He never testified before the jury, as I read the record. The record is he testified outside the presence of the jury, Mr. Tagley did. And then Mr. Abel attested to his gang affiliation. I could be wrong, but my reading is that was outside the jury's presence.
Well, correct me if I just got the impression, maybe it's a misimpression, I haven't read this record, but what you go through with all this is the heart of your case, is this drug affiliation, for heaven's sake.
Gang affiliation.
Your closing statement, the prosecutor opens with that, and he closes with that. This man was convicted, but for right or wrong, because he convinced the jury that he had been a black disciple, and those guys carry guns, and so this must be that he did that. Now, whether that's good or bad evidence is a different question, but it was the case, wasn't it?
No, that goes to the motive. That was why, because the evidence on possession, the act itself, was close. I mean, it was clearly close. And the jury, when they received this, which is why I would suggest that any error in not giving the instruction, the jury focused not upon his gang affiliation. The jury's questions upon submission were to what did Officer Sanchez see, how long did he see it, how fast was he going when he went past and he saw that throwing motion. With respect to the hat, the judge tried to clarify that because she was confused during that examination. We have the throwing motion, the arm coming back in, and a hat's on the ground. So she says, explain to me, and then she tried to get the chronology. Did the hat fall off? Did he throw it with the hat? Did he have the hat in his hand at the same time? In the end, I don't think it became any clearer than the fact that someone saw a throwing motion. So Officer Sanchez said, yeah, a throwing motion. Thereafter, another officer stays on the spot for half an hour, watches that spot. No one else comes. They send Sanchez back. Sanchez finds a gun, and how it was fashioned under the car and whether he threw it precisely there, it was serendipity. It wasn't able to be seen right away. Two ladies came out of the store that owned the car.
So what was the explanation of the hat?
It ended up being no one really got a clear explanation. It either fell off his head or it gave up when he was trying to look at it and see what the officer was up to. So that remains unclear. But the jury's focus was the throwing motion, how fast he was going, how long he saw it. That was the jury question.
How long was it before they got back to the scene where the gun was found?
I'm thinking it was 30 minutes. I think it was 30 minutes from the record, 25 to 30 minutes, because the officer, I think it's Criswell, testified. He remained on the spot, and I think it was 30 minutes from the time of the stop, the search.
Let me ask you this. If the jury's very concerned, about where the gun went or whether Hamilton actually had his hands on the gun, and had they not known he was a gang member, what is the likelihood that they would come up with the same verdict?
I think the likelihood is strong that it would have came up with the same verdict. But that would have been my position. The evidence was offered. I think a jury exercising common sense is going to say no one else threw the gun there. No one else was observed making a throwing motion. The two women that owned the SUV, they denied having any interest in the gun. In fact, they got away from it as quickly as they could. I think without the gang affiliation, they can still make this case.
Guns just don't show up in a parking lot, a Glock,
no,
I guess.
No, it didn't just fall from the sky, and it wasn't dropped there by the ladies that owned the car.
Well, the government didn't think that they could make it without the evidence at the time of trial, because that's what they argued to the jury, and that was their big argument.
They opened with it, and in the closing argument, in his opening closing, he makes an allusion to it and says, yes, he was a gang member, so you can infer from this that he has a motive for carrying the firearm. Not that there's a propensity, but he has a motive for carrying the firearm. for his protection and for protection of his drugs.
The government acknowledged what you just said very candidly and openly. It was a very close case, to put it mildly. I mean, this tips it over.
As respect to the motive, as opposed to propensity. And this is what, as I said, the jury's focus was on what was seen and what was found, not on the gang affiliation.
You got two questions from the jury. I'm always skeptical of the questions from juries of inferring. I see it on CNN every day. The jury asks this question, and then all these experts roll out, well, they're thinking da-da-da-da-da. And I've tried a lot of jury cases, and you know, you don't know what's going on in the dynamic of the jury. It's common sense to you. It sheds some light on it, I'm sure, but I wouldn't go too far with saying that's the basis of the jury verdict.
I'm focusing upon what I believe the jury would have went for in this particular instance.
I don't know what they would have done.
So in the end, we would suggest that the judge in this instance did not err in admitting this evidence of gang affiliation. With respect to sufficiency.
Well, why wouldn't it incumbent on the judge, sua sponte, to give a limited instruction, given all that we just said? Yeah, I heard you about there, no objection, but the judge, and I'm not suggesting Judge Atlas wasn't, she's one of the best trial judges we have, but I mean, the judge isn't sitting there as a, you know, just sitting there. I mean, she's very concerned about it. I mean, she did what good judges do. You ponder it, deliberate over it. You know, she had a full hearing. You know, et cetera, et cetera. It's, you know, there's nothing straight on, you know, and she makes the tough call, which is what, you know, judges do. They make the decision. But that said, it just struck me odd that having done that, you know, it's not that, I'm not saying that that's the end all and be all of the case, but even from the standpoint of the prosecutor, might have found it prudent, Your Honor, would you consider a limiting instruction?
Yes,
I mean, protect the case, and you're moving on down the road. So, I mean, it's just a little odd given all the attention that was done to it and how much the government was going to rely on it as part of his case to have insulated this by the limited instruction. As I said, my question isn't suggesting that
the absence
of a limited instruction turns the case over, but just where there's this much attention to it and the government alert on it, it does sort of at least give me a little pause. Now that you want to get into the head of the jury and say what they didn't. What was the defendant's, I mean, we know he didn't testify, so the defense was what, the cross-examination of the officers?
It was cross-examination of the officers that nothing was seen, and he denied knowing anything about a gun at his initial arrest. And retrospectively, I think the instruction would better have been, the jury would have been better served with an instruction, but that said, I think that the error was in effect waived in this instance, and I think the jury had sufficient before it to make the case, notwithstanding the government's.
Well, let me come back to and ask you the question I asked counsel opposite, and that's about, I haven't read these Seventh Circuit cases. I will read them, but so I'm glad you gave the cites to them. Sumlin is a case cited in the brief, and counsel opposite has argued it, and it is one of these where, you know, it's similar to this in terms of the kind of drugs, et cetera, it's close and all that, and the panels seem to wrangle over whether the evidence is intrinsic, extrinsic. The government usually gives us dual theories, pick one or pick both. So there the case tees up saying it's intrinsic, and the panel found that because of the closeness of the evidence, the intrinsic evidence was harmful, and they reversed. So how would, I'm going to assume you would distinguish it, but just give me your take on Sumlin and how it informs or not.
Well, my distinction here is the nature of the case, and this is one of those in which it furthers the investigation. The discovery of the drug was the extrinsic evidence, furthers the investigation. It's what drove the investigation back to the gun in the first instance. In the usual case, as in Sumlin, it's usually a narcotics case, coincidentally involving the guns.
Let me ask you a question about the physical layout. I got the impression that at trial the government did not offer any photographs of the scene or the relationships between them. Maybe they did. But you have a car parked head end, I take it, and then and the driver, in the government's theory of the case, takes a gun. What kind of gun was it?
A Glock. Glock semi-automatic.
Okay. That 3 pounds or so, or 2.5. Anyway, so he throws it over the top of the car.
I'm thinking he threw it left-handed is what I'm thinking. He threw it left-handed outside, he threw it to the driver's side.
Did he throw it over the top of the car?
No,
he threw it. Or he threw it out to the
side? No, he parked. It's from his driver's side. It's on the right side of the vehicle next to him.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, it's on the right side of the vehicle next to him. So essentially, he's leaning out the door and throws it, okay. I would think, underhand. And at that some point in time, the cap falls off where he's got the cap in his hand.
So, he's not throwing it to a car to the right. The reason I thought you were saying that throwing it to the right is that all the descriptions you give is that he's got this upward motion throwing this thing up, but now it turns out he's actually throwing it laterally.
No, laterally forward.
And forward.
Left, to the left. Forward.
And so he did it up in the next space or what? How far? I thought it was two spaces over.
One space over. I believe it was SUV right next to him.
It was right next to him. Okay, yes. Good. And where was it found in proximity to that car?
Whenever I drop anything out of a car, it always slides under whatever the next car is. That's just what happens.
It happens in a serendipity where it ends up.
Well, I know. I'm trying to
go ahead.
I understand that. I want you to clarify this for me because I'm puzzled about the cap, and I'm puzzled about the accent upon the guy's throwing motion outside the car itself. Now, if I'm sitting in the car and I'm throwing just laterally out to the side, that's one motion, right? And then if I'm trying to throw it in some, but the description was of somebody tossing it crossways. I don't know how you have this upward motion to toss this thing laterally in front.
It was described, as I recall, as a rebound. He saw his arm coming back from a throwing motion. And it would almost have to be left-handed if he's throwing from the driver's side. Now, that wasn't pointed out the record. I'll be not afraid to attention whether it's right-handed or left-handed. But it ends up on the left side of his car, the right side of the car parked next to him underneath the mirror. And there were no photographs.
So the throwing motion was not this. Yeah. It was this.
More or less.
Yes. Okay.
A LeBron James pass.
This throwing it this way would knock his cap off.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I have no... The cap, I remain after reviewing that evidence and that testimony and the judge's examination, I too am uncertain as to how the cap ended up on the ground. I notice my time has expired.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Turner.
Ms. Blackman, you have rebuttal.
Hello. Yes, sir. I want to start by making it clear that the gun was not found in a car adjacent to where he was parked. The record is clear in page, beginning at page 791, that it is my client's car, a vacant spot, and then an SUV.
Yep. So it slid.
I'm sorry?
It slid.
I guess so.
That's what always happens when I drop something around a car. It always slides under something else.
That would be the government's theory, that it slid two spaces over. And the testimony from the officer was specifically
found in front of the SUV beside the head.
It was the officer testified that there were several inches between the front passenger side tire of the SUV and the curb, and it was found right in between the tire and the curb.
Okay, so it slid under the. Yeah, okay.
And then the officer specifically testified that he saw the left hand made a motion like it was coming back. A lot of what I heard from the government was that there was a throwing motion. That is not what the officer testified to. He testified that he observed a hand rebounding down. Okay. As far as Sumlin goes, that is a plain error case. The court did a harmless error analysis, but also noted that there were portions of the drug evidence that the attorney did not object to, and the court specifically said that even under a plain error analysis, the result would not have been different. And the court also found specifically that the, quote, unfounded suspicion of drug transportation, which is what we have here, is extrinsic to the offense of felon in possession of a weapon. I want to again point out that we talked a lot that the government argued about motive and that's why it was admitted, but in the court's specific findings, she said that she admitted it because there's a likelihood that he had a gun in his possession because of a gang membership. The court did have the benefit of a gang expert who testified outside the presence of the jury.
Were any prints lifted from the gun?
No, Your Honor.
Was it tested for prints?
It was tested, and a fingerprint analyst testified and said that there were no prints. The officer also testified that when he found the gun, he picked it up, unloaded it, and put it in his back pocket and carried it around. And the fingerprint expert said that that could have harmed that. Here, I want to point out, too, that there was no limiting instruction. In almost every single case that this court has issued, when they have found that the trial court did not err in admitting some type of evidence like this.
Well, it hasn't been held plain error, has it, not to give a limiting instruction?
No, ma'am, it has not.
I mean, that's the problem you have.
It is, and I think that my case is different because of the overwhelming extrinsic evidence that was offered. Versus
one quick question. How long did the jury deliberate?
Right around 3 hours.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Blackman. You're court-appointed, and this panel and this court as a whole appreciates our court-appointed counsel. You've done very well in briefing and arguing the case. Mr. Turner, we're always glad to see you to come and present it. All right, before we take